It's only natural for you to delegate, being the ruler of the world. But more and more, it's begun to feel as if the world is ruling you. In hindsight, letting your vizier have so much authority was a rookie mistake. And letting the prince do as he liked with the military was maybe a bridge too far. How much longer until someone comes for the crown itself? How much longer until you and the rest of the world are living parallel lives? Parallel Lives is your recondite role-playing resource, exploring systems outside the dungeon and off the beaten Pathfinder. This episode is an hour long.
Hey, and welcome to Parallel Lives. I'm Wednesday Sophia, and today I am joined by Charles, Hugh, and Carrie.
Hi.
We are your hosts, and we are looking at Serpent's Tooth.
We're actually into reptile dentistry this month. It's going to be followed up by alligators, gums, and the iguana's tongue.
And Rocco's basilisk for some reason.
Yeah, that's weird.
Serpent's Tooth was published by Heart of the Deernicorn
and was designed by Ross Cowman with illustrations by Ryan Converse.
Serpent's Tooth is a weird game.
You have to put gauze in your mouth and you can't say words with S's in them.
That's nothing what the game is like.
It is almost completely not that. It is in fact a game about succession dramas and like the twilights of rulers.
And who controls narrative power.
Yeah. Here is the elevator pitch. One player is the GM. I know, unusual for us. That player has control over everything except for your player characters. They have control over all of the NPCs in the scenes.
I'm sorry, this is my floor. I have to get off. This is just...
Nope, sir.
Hey, all right. I'm being accosted in this elevator.
Sir, this is an opportunity of a lifetime. Listen to me. We have this king person who is the GM. The GM has normal GM powers. However, throughout the course of the game, the king can lose important parts of their king's regalia, and these pieces of regalia take the power with them. So you, as a player character, can steal, for instance, King's Sword. And stealing the King's Sword means now you have control over the threats in the game and when scenes end. And you can also steal power over the NPCs. You can also steal power over the setting.
I think we're going to get to, at some point here, to what extent this game actually does or doesn't realize this design. I think that's a little preview into Hugh's rants for the second half of the episode, but just some fair warning that it's coming up, and in case you're...
I have some thoughts on this. I'm excited.
So, this is a game that is diceless, but not GM-less, and the conflict resolution essentially comes down to who has narrative control of what. The king has narrative control to start of NPCs, of where we are, and of the threats. But everybody has basically sovereignty of their own character. So if I say, I punch your character in the face, you can either say, yeah, I get punched, I lose a tooth, or you can say, I dodge. So you have ultimate control over what happens to your character themselves.
Two of our player characters died in the course of this game.
Yes, and they were allowed to die by their owners. So the game ends under one of two conditions. Either you figure out what happens to the king, what's their fate, or the king's regalia gets stolen. And the regalia are, as we sort of mentioned, the crown representing the characters, the castle representing the places, and the sword representing the threats. The goal of the player characters is to steal these items of regalia from the king by basically plotting against the king.
Although the game is a little bit up in the air on that. It feels like that's the goal, but looking at the rulebook, it thinks of that as more an option available to players if they find it compelling. And it's an option we took, at the very least, because we found it compelling, or maybe just because as people who are playing this sort of thing to review it, it feels weird to leave a substantial part of its mechanical systems on the table untouched.
Yeah, the game is very open with how it can be played. You can just really play it as a story game and just really, like, see how it plays out. Or the players can be driven decidedly to steal regalia and thereby end the game.
Carrie's being nice. The less nice way of saying this is this game doesn't fully integrate its mechanics. They don't all necessarily work together. Some of them feel sort of tacked on and kind of optional.
I feel like that's our cue to talk about natures.
Yeah. So a couple of the mechanics that we as a group had some trouble with are the mechanics connected to the characters themselves. The king has motives, and the king's motives change as regalia is taken from them. So basically, to use the parlance of something like Apocalypse World or Monster Hearts, the king has a set of moves, and the moves change as power shifts. I sort of played a very absentee king, so I didn't put those motives into play very often.
And actually, I think that was to our detriment. Like, one of the notes I have written down specifically is that I think our game suffers a little bit for not having the king on screen nearly often enough.
Yeah, that's a thing that I want to talk about a little bit more in, like, I feel like every time I GM a game, we have to talk about, like, Carrie's GM Corner. And I would like to have an edition of Carrie's GM Corner this time.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, absolutely. Like, I have a big note here on my, like, little note sheet that says, absentee king with 3 question marks. So you can tell that I thought it was a big deal. So the king is characterized by these motives, and the PCs are characterized by having a nature. This is a potentially really, really cool mechanic that we really didn't use very much.
Carrie's being kind, we didn't use it very much because it doesn't connect to very many of the game systems.
The natures are designed to be a way to at least suggest to other players that they should act a certain way. They're sort of a soft compel, but as the rules is written, you can reject that other player's interpretation of your character or say, well, yes, but I'm going to do this rather than that. They don't actually have any teeth. I can see why they're there as sort of hints for how you might make the characters try and interact with each other in a certain way.
Can we explain them before we get into their faults? Would that make sense?
Maybe. I mean, okay. They're natures. They're one-word personality descriptions.
But they have a flip side.
But the flip side is optional. It's optional to
flip
it.
Yeah, for sure. But, like, basically, you have an open-faced nature, but a secret nature that is the opposite.
It seems like...
And you can flip it when you'd like.
It seems like the basis of a totally other different game that's about characters having a true and a secret nature. And
darkest
stories.
Self that bubbles to the surface under certain specific conditions with wide-ranging mechanical effects.
Monster Hearts is not in this ludography.
I am actively surprised.
When I first saw the natures, I actually first thought of a game that we have played, but didn't end up making a podcast about, so I'll only touch on it briefly. We are here to see the evil wizard Cormacar, which has all players having like a public and secret face. But in that, it's sort of like a hidden identity game. Whereas in this, the way I see natures at least, is they're actually part of character creation. And you take a nature because it gives you both a baseline guide to how your character acts from the start and sort of an arc that you can play out through the course of the game.
And to be fair, that actually did work. I wouldn't have decided that my character was going to be a gung-ho proponent of torture as part of an initiation into our cult if I hadn't chosen the insane nature.
And I think that that seems to be the case for everybody. Like, Wednesday's character was pretty well defined by her nature. Charles's character was in a lot of ways defined by his nature, but, like, he was quietly passionate. So they did form a good foundation for our characters, which I will say, I think is an extremely important thing to do when you're making up your characters on the fly. Having any kind of baseline, I think, is really, really valuable. But I do agree that the mechanical implications involving, like, I'm provoking your nature, or, like, I'm gonna flip my nature, were not as present.
In response to your provocation, I reveal my true and secret self, who is a different character in some ways. And, like, that's theoretically a pretty cool high-drama moment, and we never really managed to pull it off because it felt
Wednesday
like the incentives to do it were rarely there.
But yeah.
Yeah.
I wonder if in part that isn't a little bit reversion to mean storytelling gameplay, which is something that I think maybe as a playgroup we suffer from a bit, where in the absence of feeling the rules sort of click properly, we default to a mutually agreeable storytelling gameplay style.
It's fair.
So I think that's a criticism of the game, not a criticism of us, because every group will have a natural mode that they find themselves in, and sometimes that clicks with the game, sometimes that doesn't click with the game, but this game didn't seem like it did enough to create a specific style of play to get us out of that.
Is it the time when we say thing that I feel like I say almost every time about almost every game, drive towards conflict and revelation?
I want to be clear that I was deliberately, in many circumstances, trying to make space for conflict.
Oh, you'll be surprised how often providing space for conflict leads to players avoiding it.
Yup. You could say that that is one of my flaws as a GM.
No, you need to thrust them into situations which there are not easy conflict resolution outs to. and then the plot advances.
Yeah, I guess I just figured in a situation where everybody is a scheming member of a cult, which is what we were doing. Oh, is Carrie the GM? Are we in a cult?
Yeah, so at the end of the game manual, it lists off the ludography of the games that went into it. One of them, and this is true probably for a lot of things we played for this podcast even, was Fiasco. And it's interesting to see what it did and did not take from Fiasco, because one thing that Fiasco has that this game does not is a very set amount of scenes that the game will take, and then it is over. And we played this game in two sessions, not by intent, but because for the first 3.5 hours, during which I had a good time, but during the first three and a half hours, we had, you know, slower setting building, character building scenes, and we weren't pushing towards that seizure of regalia that perhaps we should have been.
I think especially the final hours of the game where regalia had been seized fired on so many more cylinders for me that, again, that exhortation to move towards conflict with quickness and with purpose strikes me as unusually important here, because it's the thing that brings the game's mechanics into their own.
I do want to defend myself a little bit here by saying that the GM's duty is not to introduce plots to steal regalia. That's something that the characters have to do themselves. So there is kind of an odd thing where, like, as GM, if left to my own devices, the story is gonna be slow, because the only way I can end the story is to figure out a way for us to figure out the ultimate conclusion of, like, what happens to the king. Whereas the players can be like, all right, I'm stealing regalia. So there is some, like, complication there, I guess.
I disagree about the pacing of this game. I thought we got it actually pretty close to perfect.
Interesting. Wow.
In that I think a slow first act and a fast second act is pretty much how you want a game like this to go. You want to give your characters a chance to develop, have a little bit of exposition, figure out who they are, why they might be in conflict with each other, and then you want to have a couple of things happen that force them to make hard choices with real consequences, resulting in people dying, things being lit on fire, and the game coming to a head. I also think we broke the game into two pretty nice sessions. I thought the overall plot of this game that we came up with is probably our best work.
Interesting.
Yeah, I have a tendency to agree. I really liked the story that we ended up telling. I think that it had a good rise and fall. I see some very, very strong contrasts with our game of the Shab al-Hiri Roach, which also took two sessions. By the end of the Shab al-Hiri Roach, there were still a lot of characters that we were like, who are you? What do you do? But here we had
a playset of approximately similar size. You're filling out three classes of characters, each with three characters within it. Our classes were founders and devotees and new recruits for the cult. And you know, there are three banners, each with three sections, each section having three things within it. I think the game designers might have a favorite number. But most of those felt defined, or at least fleshed out, or like they had, at a bare minimum, one good NPC trait to work with.
I just want to touch on briefly here, and it's possible that Carrie's point might go first. The way in which these work, actually, and I know we don't want to go too deep into the rules. These regalia each have a distinct list of things depending on which king you choose. And there's several pre-made kings of varying amounts of things you would expect or not.
Kings are your play sets. They come with some fill-in-the-blank stuff and some multiple choice stuff. The fill-in-the-blank stuff gives you locations, characters, and threats. The multiple choice stuff defines some other portions of your location and some things about your king.
It's a very neat, very quick way to build your own Fiasco playset.
Listen to our episode of Fiasco for more on that. But the one weird thing about that is, while I feel like all of our characters got explored to the extent that I'm like, oh yeah, I know what's going on with Jenny, I know what's going on with Janet, I know what's going on with Solar Madison, because we have to choose all these elements ahead of time before we really know what the game's going to be like, sometimes they can feel a little bit strange. Specifically, our threats have a number of things that we did not ever use, and it's not a big deal that the Department of Agriculture didn't show up, but it did make it strange where near to the end of the game, I got control of the threats, and I had to look and be like, well, I have the Sheriff Department, and I can use that, but it's really strange to use the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms here without, like, kind of contorting into some weird shapes.
No, it's weird to look over your new set of powers and just go like, oh, actually, I don't think we've touched that. And on the one hand, that's a lot of latitude to build it out in whatever direction you'd like. On the other hand, introducing new antagonists or trying to flesh out characters in what will almost necessarily be the second or third act of your game can occasionally feel like dropping something in out of the sky.
Yeah, I want to cover this a little bit more in Carrie's GM Corner. But before I do that, I have a yes or no question for you. So you took over the characters most of the way through the game.
Yep.
Did you feel like the characters were generally speaking fleshed out enough that you like felt comfortable taking that mantle? Because Wednesday clearly didn't feel totally comfortable taking the threat's mantle, but did you?
By and large, I think that I did. For most of them, I was sure of at least the thumbnail sketch, two-sentence description version of who they were supposed to be. And so I felt pretty comfortable taking those up. And when I didn't, it was pretty simple to be like, hey, what have we established about Jenny?
I did something good.
So maybe this is territory that you want to talk about in your corner, Carrie, but I'm going to be a little bit critical about whether I feel that this game actually successfully makes the transfer of narrative authority midway through the game to a potentially different game runner something that's actually a productive feature or something that's actually really sort of distinguishing. It seems to me that this game lives or dies based on whether your group is mutually dedicated to telling a good story, sort of entirely separately from the premise of sort of competing to steal parts of the king's authority away. And that disconnect between what is realistically a mechanical need to cooperate or like people are going to go home really unhappy and a in-universe at least implication that this, there's supposed to be some competition happening here doesn't seem like a productive ludonarrative synergy to me.
I do think that this game requires an extra super, like, gentleman's code.
Yeah. This game has the bones of an RPG with a winner. It has features that would have appeared in games that are directly and truly adversarial. Most famously, it's like top-line elevator pitch feature, stealing GM powers from the GM. But it doesn't have a winner. In fact, I had to kind of remind myself of it a couple of points where I was like, I think I'm seeing a conflict and winning-based model of storytelling gaming taking hold here, in spite of the fact that there really, really ultimately isn't one. And yeah, I don't know that those integrate well with one another.
I felt pretty strongly that they didn't, and I had to make a choice that didn't seem to make sense mechanically, but made a lot more sense story-wise to just try and write towards what felt like a good ending to the game, even if that meant my character got her head bashed in. I liked the way that worked, I had fun with it, but there's a reason I hadn't played this game before we decided on playing it for the podcast, and that's actually that I was aware of people in my dormitory in college who had played this game on it, and at least on one occasion it led to some, like, serious hurt feelings and upset people not happy about what happened in the game where they were all squabbling with each other for 3 hours.
It has an unusual amount of an ability to god mode your friends, and it's god moding from behind also being a PC in the world, and yeah, no, I think I've never seen a game as fertile for major breakdowns of collaborative storytelling as this theoretically non-competitive storytelling game.
And that's really interesting. Like, so my perspective is obviously totally different because I was the GM. So I really didn't notice that kind of conflict at all.
I think your perspective is only different because you made an active choice to play a king who was interested in making a good story happen, not a king who was scrabbling to stay in power.
I think, yeah, one of the dreams of the game is that over time, the player who was the GM becomes a player who is like the other players and that all they have is their one character that they have control over. Mm-hmm. So there's, I guess, a hope to reduce the GM at last to being merely one of the player characters because there's a sort of aesthetic charge to that loss of power that is one of the primary aesthetic attractions of the setting, I guess.
Yeah, no, that is definitely interesting and definitely fair. And I think that you could squabble for power. I really think you could. But yeah, absolutely. You would really have to be careful. And it's sort of, for me, a shame and like a weird point of serious tension that I actually think that the fact that this definitely has no winner is an improvement over what I would consider like the Jason Morningstar model of Fiasco or of Dulce, where there is a winner, but it's really sort of like strangely and artificially like decided, and like you'll be like, oh, that's not where my arc was going. I guess that's how that happens though, okay. But on the other hand, absolutely, the fact that there's no mechanical winner, the fact that good faith is one of the most important play skills here, does mean that it can either go worse than Fiasco or it can go better than Fiasco. And that's a sort of tough position to be in.
There's a real way in which this game, more than a lot of the ones we've played, feels like it would really benefit from people playing it multiple times, from like people getting good at it, kind of, or being natural at it. And I don't know that that's the thing that people will want to do necessarily, because I don't think this game is the perfect example of the kind of mechanics that it's putting forward. It's just the best one that I've encountered. Because I don't know other games where you're stealing GM power like this. And also, the way that that would work would change a lot if we had, and I want to say this, and it's not against you, my friend, as the GM, if we had a more active king who is more of a current character going on, and we had ways in which, when we changed how the king worked, it felt like a thing that was going to show up in a lot of personal ways. And look, I think having a cult leader is just kind of a setting where the king takes a background a lot of the time. In no surprise to anyone, this is our third game for this podcast we've had where we played a cult.
Wait, what's the other one? There's obviously Dread.
There's Dread in My Life with Master, which is not exactly a cult.
Oh, okay, fair enough. That's fine. Always all the games I've GM'd.
I noticed that.
What's going on here?
It seems to me that this game is also, in some respects, a game for people who've played other storytelling games and are interested in the meta game that is shuffling the narrative authority around. And if that's an experiment you're interested in, it's probably better to approach it as a exercise in mind meld and creative flow and letting another person sort of take over where you left off, rather than the competitive thing that the game actually sets it up to be. Which is, again, I think, a design flaw. But I see flaws in things. Maybe they're not flaws.
I mean, and the flaws are really there. Like, there's a sense in which role-playing games exist to abrogate the I shot you, no I didn't question of childhood make-believe. There are hundreds of different faces put on a solution to that problem of how to engage in a make-believe a little bit more structured and a little bit less likely to fail because one person just loves their own interests in the story that gosh darn much. This marks the only game where I think we legitimately had a moment of conflict that was kind of, I shot you, no you didn't. Surely something has gone wrong if that conflict is still possible.
Gotta say, as a rhetorician, I found that conflict very interesting because it highlights the difference between actions and words.
I feel like I should say here, I'm being very positive about this game, partially because I had a very good time playing it, and I don't think that what praise I have given it is completely unearned, but there's also a way in which he was not wrong. The mechanics of this game are a bit scattershot and are a bit imprecise. And like, I would be really interested in the Serpent's Tooth 2.0 or like a second edition or something. It's like, I do like the heart of this game, I feel like.
So I want to take a minute here to pose kind of a formula for a story. You got your basic conceit, the kind of narrative that your game is setting out to build and simulate. In this game, it's a game about a king falling from power, interpreted as loosely as you want. This game provides what is, at heart, a fairly conventional set of rules for how you should go about telling the story and acting out the scenes in the game, with the caveat that things get weirder as these functions get split between multiple players, as regalia are stolen and the story unfolds. That said, none of the rules that compose these sets of powers are strange or very different or would be out of place in another storytelling game. That brings me to what I think is the third part of the storytelling game trichotomy, which is the mechanical complications. The mechanical complications in this are natures and this thing about stealing regalia.
And motives. And teeth.
Yeah, that's part of stealing regalia. I was trying not to get into the nitty-gritty. Yeah. I don't think those are very good in this game. Or they don't have good synergy with the conceit of the game or with general enjoyment. There's a meta level in which your rules have to make a game that's fun rather than a game that's unpleasant to play on some aesthetic level.
Yeah, I'd be willing to co-sign a lot of that. I'm not totally sure about the distinction you've drawn between the rules and the mechanical complications, but the things that you've cited as being in that third part of the trichotomy are also unequivocally the parts of it that I think are the weakest in the game.
Let me see if I can make clearer the point that I'm trying, the distinction I'm trying to draw there. So you have the basic sort of procedures of the game, the text in the rules, the text in the manual that's essentially of a kind with the text in any other storytelling game. So, you know, take turns acting of a scene, the procedures for how you set a scene, how you do this, how you do that.
Okay.
You know, this game has ones that just say set scenes that work in the story, whereas Fiasco has a very specific procedure.
So it's the difference between, say, the way that D20 systems build out their combat mechanics versus the fact that D20 systems share a similar structure where each player plays one PC who is their character, who no one else will narrate as, who is opposed and assisted by a single GM.
I'm trying to get into a slightly finer grain distinction there, where it's the procedures are the basic stuff that structure the game. Like we mentioned, this game does not have a fixed number of scenes. Other games might have a fixed number of scenes. There are different permutations on how you can set those procedures up for a storytelling game. This has a fairly open-ended set of procedures. The Chevalier Roach has a much more rigid set of procedures in that it prescribes exactly what the setting of each scene will be.
Mm-hmm.
The procedures that this game provides you are generic and harmless. The complications that are layered on top of that are different.
I do want to say that even though we are being pretty critical, when I say we, I mean not me, but Hugh and Charles are being pretty critical of the mechanics of this game, I do want to note that we did use literally all of them to quite a bit of effect. Like, I struggled to use motives, but when I used my motives, like, that was a really important and, like, game-changing scene. So I think there is some there. That's all I'm saying.
You haven't heard me bad-mouthing it. I haven't called it a steaming pile of garbage, a waste of paper. You know, look, at this point, if you listen to this podcast, you could probably guess that I think this game is mostly all right.
He has not once accused the author of not understanding math.
It's true. This is no My Life with Mathster.
Charles, so near to the end of the game, you and I were the ones who stole regalia. So we were the ones who got to take some of that GM power and roll around in it. How did that feel?
Conflicting. On the plus side, you get a new and interesting set of things that you can do to shape the story. On the other side, you feel looming over your shoulder at all times the ways in which anytime anyone does anything involving anything within your purview, it is up to you to just be like, eh, no. Prior to my stealing authority over characters, one of the founders of the cult, and by necessity a reasonably important character to a couple of points of the plot, had been sent to a cabin in the woods where she was expected to stay, I think for probably the remains of the action of the plot. I kind of had things I wanted to do with that character, and I was keenly aware that, like, I can just sort of no sell that move to bring in the squared circle to this discussion, but that in some sense that would have been metagame rude. And so I stayed by that decision. So there's an inherent conflict in gaining GM powers midway through a game in which you have probably actively been encouraged to build a character who is, like, scheming and trying to manipulate events, and then suddenly midway through you gain godlike powers to do so to your advantage. And again, you just have to remind yourself every couple of minutes, there are no winners to this game. Nothing is better because your plan worked out. And that's, yeah, I don't know. Also, there's a thing that we haven't talked about much, which is, hopefully I won't be running too far afield, but gaining a whole new set of narrative powers midway into a game sure did produce some slowdowns for us.
It did do that.
Yeah, exactly as our plot picked up, our game started to move slower because the things we'd done to make the plot pick up were also causing us to just play slower qua players, which is, again, like you mentioned, like this seems like a game that you might want to get good at, and I really pretty strongly agree with that.
Yeah, no, it's a weird one because suddenly you have to care about new rules most way through, which is kind of a strange flow there for the first playthrough.
Yeah, I found myself sort of like low-key GMing by making suggestions because I was used to having all the cards in my hands. And so I could be like, well, you know, this character could do this.
And I did that all the time because I can't help myself.
That's
all
right.
Yeah, Hugh just never stops doing that.
Pause.
One sec. Tea break.
Tea break.
Tea time.
Tea time.
Tea time. Yeah, no, it was interesting because only near to the end of the game, even a little bit after we'd both stolen Regalia, did I realize, oh, Carrie has kind of lost all her power. And I didn't mean that just in the way that, like, the game set us up to be like, well, the king's going to lose their power, but rather like, oh, hey, this person who was GMing the whole time is now not, and that's really interesting, actually. But back to an earlier point, Hugh, you described the act of scene setting as being fairly generic, and you're not wrong, except when it turns really strange at the end once you're all having different powers and how to set the scene.
Yeah, no, it goes suddenly from ordinary downright story weird game scene setting to it's Mad Libs now.
And progress would be impossible without a shared loyalty to realism of the narrative of whatever kind it is. And that's where the game would just break. If you had players who didn't want to play cooperatively with each other, but if you took the character power and the setting power and split them up, those two players could essentially filibuster continuing the game by refusing to make coherent scenes in which anything could happen.
The next scene is at the bunk. Nobody's there. Oh, okay.
No, suddenly, many of threat number three arrive.
Yeah, and then the
and
scene
act
ends
out a scene with themselves. Yeah, like, no, it becomes like postmodern anti-theater
and
if you don't have a cooperative group.
For context, the way that, again, there's three different powers, they control characters, threats, and setting. So when you're setting up the scenes, if three different people control those powers, that means the first person who controls the setting is like, okay, well, this scene is taking place on the moon, if that's one of your predetermined places that it could take place. The second character is like, okay, well, here are the characters that are going to show up. We have the Queen of Mars, and we have
some antediluvians.
Yeah, some antediluvians. And then the third player, halfway through that, is like, all right, now the police are here. Or are like, all right, suddenly the scene is done, right, at an important moment. And that goes suddenly from being like a normal GM thing to being this very strange synthesis, and I really enjoyed it, actually, but again, it's one of those things that could be really strange.
Yeah, God forbid anyone got to feeling weird during the strangely conflict-laden early portions of the game, perhaps actively predisposing them to begin to throw narrative monkey wrenches at each other. Look, there's a dystopian comedy available where the game starts in that state. But gosh, that's not something you want to have happen midway through a game.
No, especially because this is in a lot of ways a game about people plotting to do things and sometimes those plots being foiled. So that's just a really great recipe for some sour grapes.
Hot. 2 second digression on those plots for a moment, by the way. The rules advise you on some things to not do in your, like, regalia stealing
which
plot.
Which is really nice. I really appreciate that.
Yeah, thank except goodness for all things that, like, you'd have to be a moron to do.
Oh, that's not true.
That's not true. Nope. I mean, look, it insists that one of them is concoct a plot, but forget to make sure that the plot would actually result in you gaining the regalia. And there's one way where I go, like, yeah, what moron conducts a crown-stealing plot and forgets that at the end of it, I should possess the crown? But, like, I don't know, maybe people get too cute about their plots and really Ocean's 11 themselves and...
That's something I would do. Hello, it's me, Wednesday.
Confession corner. You're a moron.
No!
And speaking of the ways in which Wednesday is a moron, I want to use her as an example of bad play here.
Here to help.
which is, you came up with a perfectly ordinary plot to steal a thing called my character loves stealing, wants to steal a thing and then get the heck out of Dodge, and that's a cool plot, except that it both grants you the narrative authority of the regalia and just exits your player character. And I can't tell if that's a feature or a bug or something, but it sure felt like something that we stumbled into rather than doing on purpose.
So returning briefly to the threats and characters that are separate things that you can have narrative control over, this is a little weird in a way that I don't think we've quite mentioned yet, which is, or possibly realized other than me sitting here, but some of the threats are characters for this playset, which creates a very odd sort of total lacuna in the rules.
No, it doesn't. They're just, if it's a character on the threats page, they're a threat, not a character. Dunzo.
Yes, yeah. But the characters
As a person who had that had authority over exactly half of those things and not the other half, I really noticed that.
But the characters that are on the characters page can be just as much a threat as the characters on the threats page. And there's also nothing that really means that those characters have to be threats.
Yes. No, I mean, for example, so for our cult setting, for us filling out the threat sheet, one of the categories that we had to choose was taboos. And the taboos that we chose, because we have a cult setting, were pictures, monoamory, that's how you pronounce that word.
Momo armory.
Yeah, it's a peach with armory. A lot of...
Yeah, you just can't fucking do, like... bonsai shit on peaches. Never. That's not okay.
No, Batsu.
The animation quality really dropped in the second season of Sword Peach.
And books that are more than 5 years old. But this meant, because monoamory is a taboo, that it's like, okay, can I introduce two of the characters being monoamorous into a scene somehow? Can I have a closet pop open and we'll see Solar and Janet just totally doing it, or what? And similarly,
all by themselves.
All by themselves. Nobody else. With no one else.
That's not okay.
That's not sexual sharing. And these were all plot points. I'm not making up stuff now. And similarly, like, there was a character who was introduced on our character page who became kind of an enforcer character for the cult. But could I introduce her? Because we had characters that were going against the cult. Could they be a threat? But those characters that were going against the cult was my character, actually. Should I introduce this threat against myself and just play out this weird thing? Rules, huh?
It's easy to dodge, but another thing that becomes possible once someone has character control is introducing a scene starring their player character, which they control, and any constellation of NPCs over which they also have despotic control. And you can just sort of, like, play with your dolls if you want to.
Or you can summarize your dolls, or you can say, hey, Wednesday, play this doll.
Actually, the other characters are allowed to introduce themselves into sets.
Yeah. Oh, thank goodness. That is in the rules. Okay.
No, I can burst
through
the door.
I'm visiting your dollhouse.
Even regardless of whether that makes any sense or not.
Well, that's a thing that we as storytelling gamers got to go with.
Right. To wrap up some of these threads, I think something that this game points out is that rules are hard. It's a lot easier to not make a rule about something and have the absence of the rule not create destructive interference in your gameplay experience than to make a rule that necessarily contributes positively. This game consists of a set of rules. They break up into individual sheets. You can take those rules and own those rules and have the powers that those rules give you, but nothing keeps them all working together in any coherent or cohesive way other than goodwill. And that's what I gotta say.
I feel like there are a surprising and substantial number of gameplay difficulties that can be at least helped by, like, a single sentence addition to the rules, which is not even really a rule. It's really just, like, play a character who is invested in the kingdom, whatever the kingdom is. Maybe they want to rule it, maybe they don't, but play a character who is invested in the kingdom. Because that solves your cut and run situation, and it gives characters motivation to want to steal the regalia, because, you know, maybe they want to be king, maybe they want to change things, you know, maybe they don't like the king, and they don't like how they are running things. But, like, to my absolute surprise, that sentence is not in the rule book.
To take that a step further, I think what Carrie's getting at, in part, is that there's an extent to which this wants to be a bottle episode.
Mm-hmm.
And the extent that you can keep all of your conflict essentially internal to the fictional place that you're creating.
The kingdom.
In which, yes, the fictional kingdom, in which your king has power, the better off you are. And that when conflicts become external to that, it doesn't work. I had a bunch of plot ideas for my character that relied on a whole bunch of secret backstory and clever plans to do things and big things you could introduce in the third act as a big twist and a secret reveal. But it became pretty clear that those things didn't work because what we were going to spend our camera time on was going to be the other characters and the interpersonal drama between them. Really, unless the initial king does a lot of work to establish a particular set of external stakes at the beginning of the game, your conflict is going to be internal. That's maybe an area where the way Carrie played the first act could be done very differently. I don't think she did anything wrong, to be clear.
Yeah, I will also say that you could really make this game a lot tighter and a lot clearer with some very minor edits. Because the notion that characters should be invested in the kingdom...
That was Carrie's editor voice.
Yes. Yeah, that's how I talk at work all day. I don't know how my coworkers tolerate me. But the notion that characters should be invested in the kingdom and the notion that there really is a kingdom in a lot of ways, I think it's a very helpful notion because it also clarifies sort of the difference between characters and threats. Threats are potentially, through this lens, threats to the kingdom. You know, they're not threats to characters. They're threats to, like, the whole thing. You know, they're external, you know, external armies or whatever. And I think that that clarification would be helpful. It's time for another edition of Carrie's GM Corner, where I talk about my failings as a GM and my attempts to be better.
Carrie's GM Corner is humble, unlike Hugh's GM Corner, which is just angry.
Carrie's GM Corner.
Carrie's GM Corner.
Carrie's GM Corner.
So,
oh,
this
God.
Is...
I can't do that voice right now. Oh, gosh.
Thanks, marshmallow fluff.
Maple syrup. Maple syrup. So, GM notes. This is a game that, like many storytelling games, even ones that are GM'd, does not allow you almost any kind of prep. However, I do really think that between the playsets, between the fact that you are sort of given a monologue for your king, and the PCs that you have to bounce off of, it's actually not super duper duper difficult to dive into this world as long as you're interested in the world. So, you know, certainly don't play a king that you don't feel comfortable with, but if you are playing a king that you feel comfortable with, why am I comfortable with cult leaders? I think it is a shockingly easy system to just be like, all right, I'm here now, I'm doing this, I have no preparation, let's make it happen. Having said that, it really is kind of a lot to juggle because you have, you know, these characters that you're developing, you have threats, and you're like, when shall I use these? Am I holding these in reserve for something? Am I holding these in reserve for something, but by the time I would put that in action, will the regalia be gone? And in addition to that, you are playing a character, namely the king, who, you know, has a set of motives of their own and is the sort of the centerpiece of the world in a lot of ways. So, like, that is really a lot to juggle without any prep work. And I absolutely focused more on some things than others. Like, I'm pretty pleased with the character development that I was able to give most of the denizens of the kingdom. But it's absolutely true that I didn't really develop any of the threats in a real way. So, even though it's surprisingly easy to just dive in, there are some difficulties too. As Charles mentioned, there were a lot of places where I felt like I was driving to revelation, or I felt like I was providing opportunities for conflict that I was hoping players would take, and they didn't necessarily do that. And, you know, that definitely leads to some, like, boring go-nowhere scenes. And something that is, I think, unique about GMing this game is that for most of the first session, I was like, all right, I'm ready for you to take my powers away from me. Especially because I was getting a little bit tired. I was like, wow, it's a little bit tough and a little bit like exhausting to have to come up with everything off the top of my head all of the time. And to do my best to make that like interesting and not too zany or stupid. And eventually I was just like, okay, can somebody please take one of these regalias from me? I'm tired. But then once the regalias were taken from me and I didn't have like actual narrative control, I sort of wanted it back in some minor ways. I would be like, well, that's, if I were GMing, this is what I would do. Or like, oh, I would find it more interesting to do this. Or like, why are we setting a scene here? I think that it would be better to set a scene over there. So yeah, it was definitely a really like unusual experience to be like, could somebody please take one of these regalia from me? And then once they were gone to be like, but my regalia, I want them.
Heavy is the head that wears the crown.
Yeah, heavy is the head that wears the crown, but also like crowns are shiny and cool.
By the time you listen to this podcast, Game of Thrones might be done.
Oh, crazy.
I look forward to finding out from you, listener, who it is who is currently the director of communications at the White House when this episode airs. Eating this podcast, but at time of speaking, Scaramucci was out today, so...
Yeah, we just barely got that news.
The mooch is loosed.
Yeah.
Hey, look, GM power in the White House is going all kinds of weird.
And that brings us to 2.0s. Serpent's Tooth, the Trump administration.
God, what a horrible idea.
I'm so depressed and it's such an okay idea.
It makes so much sense.
I have one more tiny GM note. My tiny GM note is, if you're GMing this in the future, maybe try to remember that you're supposed to pass the mantle later. So maybe, like, try to give somebody a foothold to get into anything before you probably inevitably lose your power. That's all. Maybe remember that, because I didn't remember that at all. At all.
Yeah, so we have a depressingly topical 2.0.
In fairness, that's not a 2.0 as much as it is just a custom playset.
Yeah. It's just a custom playset, yep.
It's a good one, though. Golly.
Which gets back to my point that I think the fundamental conceit of this game is very good. This is an interesting formula for storytelling games and a formula for intrigue and drama.
Man, I'm just surprised that there aren't more works in the Western canon built on this precise moment in a king's reign. Why don't we have more of those?
Look, I wasn't saying that that was a revelation, Charles.
A revelation?
So, I'm usually willing to stump for adversarial story games, and this feels like a hand wave, but Serpent's Tooth, but there is a winner, and also we rejigger the mechanics so that you never again have to see a yes, I shot you, no, you didn't fight.
Wow, I really can't believe that that didn't end with you coming up with a sex game version of this, because it feels well suited to it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, Serpent's Head. Yeah, absolutely.
No, the regalia is... What is narrative control? What is that really?
Being forced to baptize yourself on your knees.
That, for context, was a part of the game.
Yo, this story was good. Can I just say that, like, a major part of our plot involved us burning down a museum for good reasons. A man was inside who was accidentally killed. That man turned out to be Wednesday's dad.
My character's dad.
Yes, Wednesday's character's dad. In case it wasn't clear that this was all fictional. We, the players, did not burn down a museum, okay?
Or kill my dad.
We have a lot of respect for knowledge. And for Wednesday's International Dad of Mystery. That's a joke about real life. So, the cult leader was not informed that we were going to burn down this museum as a cult. But Wednesday's character didn't know that. And therefore, fucking kills the cult leader with a bus at the end. Like, that's actually kind of cool.
A real dramatic irony happened.
Yeah, we did it. We made a fiasco plot. Like, whatever, that's rad.
No, I felt good about it. And
As I said, I think this had actually the best overall plot structure of any of our games.
One thing, too, not exactly a 2.0, but I think actually the playsets for this, the various kings it gives, they're a mix of kind of generic and kind of weird, but I think the weird ones are all pretty interesting, actually, for things to be built into the game. Like, there's one which is the Dungeon Master, which is sort of a meta plot where you play you know, a dungeon master and all the characters are like things that live in the dungeon, which is interesting to me at least.
But is there a zookeeper playset?
There's Taco King.
Yeah, but is
Taco King
zoo?
Is the sad zoo of this one. No, I mean, it's low stakes, but the human misery is really high. Like, that's what always called to me about sad zoo. It's not that I, like, particularly love sad zoos. It's that I was like, oh,
love human misery.
Domestic level plot.
We could hack in a sad zoo. There's rules for making your own king. It would be either a zookeeper or a giraffe because they're very tall. No, actually, it would be a lion.
The king of the beasts.
Oh, but lions aren't very tall. Okay, you're right.
Elvis and kinghood are not related concepts.
The real problem is they don't have, like, a lot of physical possessions. You have to stretch yourself on the regalia a little bit.
That's always been my problem with giraffes.
Oh, the regalia is the mane. It gets shaved.
Oh, no.
Oh, no.
Oh, no. Someone didn't clean himself very well, and now his mane's all matted. What a plot to steal the crown this was.
Ralph! That's the king.
So, anyways,
that's
yeah.
probably how it feels if you're a cat.
My regalia!
So who's this game for?
I have an answer to this question. I think this is a game for anybody who is looking to GM a system like Apocalypse World or Monster Hearts. Because those systems are extremely hard to GM. This system is easier to GM, but is still a good, like, I think, introduction to the weirdnesses and, like, you know, preparation-free, play-it-by-earness of those systems. That's what I think.
I think that this game is for experienced or semi-experienced story gamers looking to experiment.
All right, charitable version. This game is for people who like the general conceit and don't mind some clunky mechanical nonsense.
That's fair.
Uncharitable version. This game is for people who are looking for a game to play with people you're looking to permanently alienate from each other and from you.
That's part of our who not to be for, I think. But
if
yeah.
you have friendships you'd like to end. And
friendships.
And surround yourself with people who base personality traits like really need to be brought to the surface more readily, then this game is for you and them.
Can I just say that we had like one moment of very brief conflict in this thing? So it wasn't like nobody got into any fights.
Oh yeah, no. And that,
that just means you missed the internal conflicts.
Womp womp.
Or the ones that were even lower key. Like, I spotted moments that existed. The thing that I've been worrying with myself about in answering this is I'm tempted by the phrase, this game is for people who all got together and decided as a group that they wanted to play an evil party in the last D&D game they played. And on the one hand, scheming, conniving, court intrigue, but it's a story game and it doesn't take forever. And you can steal things, and those things have not just merely, like, in-world your character now technically has a pile of gold value, but, like, reshape the whole pattern of play value. And so maybe if you're the sort of person who thinks that, like, scheming to steal something and carrying out that scheme is good, maybe that's a really rewarding play experience for you. On the other hand, is that set of players nearly coterminous with the players who storm off in a huff when you countermand them either in rules or in play? Yeah. And would those people be uniquely poorly suited to this game? Also, yeah. So, like, that's kind of who I want to recommend it to, but it might just be because I want to hurt those people.
A better version of what I was trying to say.
No, I mean, to sum it up, this game, more than anything that we've played, save maybe for Juggernaut, has the greatest potential for bleed, so be careful.
I remember on our Fiasco podcast, I said, this is not a game for people who are possessive. This is not a game for people who are really interested in having their character succeed. This game is that, but like more, which really surprises me. I didn't really think that there was a more than Fiasco with regard to that, but I think there is, and I think it's absolutely Serpent's Tooth. So yeah, I think that Charles is totally right though. If you have a group of people who are like, yes, we like to play the evil party, but actually the story is the most important thing to us when it comes to the end of the day, like that's who this game is super for. And they can play Taco King, and I cannot.
Did we already do 2.0s? Can we do 2.0s for
real? I mean,
real?
You can do them again.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, we did some. We can split it up.
Actual 2.0 for this game. Just take the basic ideas of this game, but write a significantly more detailed set of rules that place significantly more nuanced and rigid limits on what you can and can't do with each regalia, and also give it a more rigorous procedure for how you set scenes in the game and how many there will be, in what order they occur, etc., etc., who has to be in them, etc., and make the regalia interact with those. Admittedly, this is the kind of design idea where you take something that's complicated and not working and you make it more complicated in a hope that eventually the levels of complexity will sort of reach some kind of stasis point and they'll be balanced out with each other. And that's never really a great way to design anything, but I think that's the direction you have to go with this game to both keep its spirit and end up with something more mechanically robust. Other 2.0s, take this game, remove the mechanical effects of the regalia, keep them as part of the conceit and premise of the game, and put in an alternate mechanism by which players earn narrative control away from the GM.
Mm-hmm.
In that case, what you have is this kind of intermediate GM storytelling game where the players have the ability to step in by playing secret cards that they have in hand to surprisingly take control of the narrative briefly in some rigorously bounded way. And the players basically play a dual role of being characters and throwing twists into the story that the storyteller is creating.
Okay.
That's something that I think looks a lot like this game, keeps the basic conceits, probably can even keep the setups and playbook, like the kings and associated kingdoms, but is actually a game that I'd like to play. It builds on some of the strengths, the kingdom setup, the, I think, reasonably useful generic structure for a storytelling game, and takes it in a direction that keeps some of the intent of this without as much potential for bleed, as Wednesday put it.
It would be interesting to incorporate the playsets as like cards that you could play from your hand as well, because that allows you to... So something that we may not have fully mentioned is that everybody, we all build the playset together. You know, we have devotees and the players are responsible for naming the devotees, for example. So you could, for example, as a player, come up with, you know, a taboo item or a threat or whatever and sort of like kind of have something in mind. Just be like, oh, I can see how this would work in the story and I would like that. And if you're able to like toss in elements, that potentially allows you to, you know, sort of steer an element in the direction that you intended it to go when you wrote it down in the first place.
Yeah, that's very much the kind of thing I was sort of vaguely thinking at.
Yeah, I think that that's potentially a cool idea. Honestly, I had like a fucking reskin of this shit going down in my head the other night. It was probably goth. Let's just say it was goth. I don't remember what it was, and
oh, no.
I'm fucking mad. So, sorry about that.
A serpent's vermouth.
Rad. Damn. You probably shouldn't give alcohol to snakes.
No. They're sloppy drunks.
Sloppy. But they can't really fall downstairs because they're snakes.
Thump, 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 thump.
Like a really fat, like, on. Oh, snakes are good. That's the official opinion of this podcast.
Yeah.
Snakes are good.
Anyway, do we have anything more to say? Or are we about wrapped up? Where are we at recording time?
1:20.
Okay, that's all right.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah.
That's it, guys.
It'll probably be an oversized
podcast.
We're done. That's good.
We did it.
And
to all the ships at sea, good night.
Dear listeners, we love you. And
Apex,
that's the tooth.
Hey, thanks for listening to Parallel Lives. You can find Serpent's Tooth online at heartoftheunicorn.com for $9.95. If you want to find the show online, we're at parallelurl.com. theparallelpodcast@gmail.com or the Parallel Lives Tabletop Podcast on Facebook. If you want to make us happy, why not review us on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher Radio? If you want to hit us up on Twitter, the podcast is at Parallel Chat, I am at Wednesday Quest, Hugh is at Ionic Bother, Carrie's at Baroque Emotions, and Charles is at Gush for You with the number 4 and the letter U. This episode was produced by me, with music by Kevin MacLeod. Check back next week for The Beast, an unsettlingly erotic game for one. That episode's a half an hour long. See ya.
I had to edit out like 20 minutes of us talking about X-Files continuity.
You really what? Didn't.
What?
Give me that back.
I almost left it in, but kind of the context wasn't there to make it make sense to anyone.
Okay, but you gotta leave in us talking about X-Files.
I don't remember
right?
if I did or
like,
not.
Those have been deep cuts that our listeners will be here for by the time they've listened to
There's 19 There's a lot of confusion
of
about whether a name of an episode was a name of a separate show, and it wasn't fully well explained.
Why didn't I know that?
You did know that, but other people didn't know that. You referred to it too offhandedly, almost. And people were left in the dust, including the listeners. In this case, me. This has been your Parallel Lives Inside Look, Between the Lines.
Read Between the Lives.